On April 9th, 1945, Dietrich Bonhoeffer was hung by German soldiers. He was executed for his suspected involvement in a plot to overthrow Hitler and the Nazi regime. Bonhoeffer was a Lutheran minister who began speaking out against Hitler soon after he became Germany's chancellor in 1933. And Bonhoeffer and others with him warned about the dangers of submitting to Hitler's will, while at the same time, the German Lutheran Church, which was the official church of Germany, the German Lutheran Church began to acquiesce to Hitler's wishes. And soon the Nazis effectively controlled the German Lutheran Church. Bonhoeffer continued to speak against Hitler, and he began to train ministers who would not bow to the demands of the Nazi Party. He was eventually arrested for his opposition, and 2 years later, he was executed. Now, I disagree with Bonhoeffer on several significant theological points, but Dietrich is a model of persistent refusal to participate in wickedness despite intense pressure and persecution. And in Daniel 1, we read about four boys who remained faithful to God despite intense pressure. So let's read beginning in verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God. And he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God. Then the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles, young men, in whom there was no blemish, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace and whom they might teach the language and literature of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies, and of the wine which he drank, and 3 years of training for them, so that at the end of that time they might serve before the king. Now from among those of the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And to them the chief of the eunuchs gave names. He gave Daniel the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now God had brought Daniel into the favor and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, "I fear my lord the king, who has appointed your food and drink. For why should he see your faces looking worse than the young men who are your age? Then you would endanger my head before the king." So Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Please test your servants for 10 days and let them give us vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be examined before you and the appearance of the young men who eat the portion of the king's delicacies. And as you see fit, so deal with your servants." So he consented with them in this matter and tested them 10 days. And at the end of the 10 days, their features appeared better and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. Thus the steward took away their portion of delicacies and the wine that they were to drink and gave them vegetables. In 605 BC, the Babylonian Empire was engaged in war with Egypt. Between Babylon and Egypt lay a sparsely inhabited region dotted with insignificant kingdoms ruled by unimportant kings. One of those kingdoms allied itself with Egypt and began to fight against the invading Babylonians. As a result, Nebuchadnezzar was forced to engage the capital of that kingdom in battle. That kingdom was Judah, and its capital city was Jerusalem. Nebuchadnezzar defeated Jerusalem, stole some of its treasures, and to ensure the king of Judah's good behavior, he took the children of the king and other nobles as captives and hostages. The author of the book of Daniel was one of those captives. Now, the book of Daniel says nothing about what happened to Daniel or the other captives on their journey from Jerusalem to Babylon. But to paint the picture a little bit, I want to talk a little bit about what history tells us they went through. Now, many of them, if not all of them, were children who had been forcibly removed from their homes. They were then shackled together in a long line, chains between all of them, and they were dragged out of the city to never return to their family. Again, these captives, even though they were king's sons and they were the sons of nobles, they were not treated as nobility or honored guests. They were not carried in sedan chairs on the shoulders of Babylonian soldiers. They were prisoners and slaves. They were chained together and forced to walk the entire 750 miles from Jerusalem to Babylon, a journey of several weeks. This is not a pleasure stroll. These are not members of a caravan that are riding along in comparative comfort. So do not think of these captives as if they were like the American pioneers who traveled west with their wagons. Think of these prisoners in terms of the Bataan Death March or the Cherokee Trail of Tears. This was an incredibly difficult journey. Everyone on it suffered. Probably many died along the way. Those who survived were still captives in Babylon. And Nebuchadnezzar instructed the master of his eunuchs, a man named Ashpenaz, to select certain ones who had survived the journey that were free from any physical defect, were attractive, had great wisdom, much knowledge, and were quick to understand. These select captives were the best looking and the smartest of all of those taken from Jerusalem. Daniel was one of those special select captives. Also chosen were three other Hebrew boys, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And these four were trained to serve as wise men, we might say court officials, overseers. They were counselors and servants of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, we don't know how old these four Hebrews were when they were taken, but the most commonly agreed upon guess, and I think it's the best guess, is they were still in their early teens. They were old enough to understand abstract subjects, but still young enough to be molded into the Babylonian way of thinking. And their training began with a name change. Verse 7 tells us. All four of them had Hebrew names which referenced the God of Israel. So for example, Daniel meant, God is my judge. They were given new names which reflected they were no longer among worshipers of Jehovah. So Daniel is now Belteshazzar, and Hananiah, Shadrach, Mishael is Meshach, and Azariah is Abednego. And we don't know exactly what their Babylonian names meant. There's some difference of opinion on this, and it's not really clear. But pretty certain is they all make reference to Babylonian God. So the Bel in Belteshazzar is the same as the god Baal, worshipped by the Canaanites. A different spelling and pronunciation, but the same basic god. The Ak in Shadrach and Meshach is a form of the name of the Babylonian moon god, Aku. The end of Abednego's name was a form of the name of Marduk's son, Nebo. So they're all named in relation to the gods of the Babylonians. In addition to receiving new names, the four Hebrews were physically mutilated. They were castrated and made into eunuchs. Now, the Bible doesn't say this directly, but it is the best conclusion from the information it presents. These four men were put under the supervision of Ashpenaz, the chief, the master of the eunuchs, implying that all those under his care were eunuchs. We also know from history that many court officials and servants of Babylonian kings, particularly those who were captive slaves, were eunuchs. And so three things have happened to these men to strip them of their identity. They're taken from their home and country. They were given new names. And they were physically mutilated in a way which would have profoundly affected their physical development as men. These young men suffered harsh, life-altering realities, which would have stripped away some of their sense of who and what they were. They were also given the finest foods to eat. So that verse 5, the king appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies and of the wine of which he drank. So they're given portions of that which Nebuchadnezzar himself ate. These are rations from the king's own food supply. So this is saying more, very carefully is saying more than that the king made sure they were fed. He didn't just order them to be fed. They were fed with the same kind of foods that the king ate. If you will, this food was taken out of the king's own refrigerator. And it was done by order of the king. And Nebuchadnezzar had probably two reasons at least for this. Number one, these men were being trained to serve before the king. So they were to be as well fed and healthy as possible. They were not given gruel, which was barely enough to keep them alive. They were given rich foods, which would give them the appearance of being very well fed and healthy. And also, being fed from the king's food meant they were now directly dependent on the king. He was feeding them out of his own resources. This has the appearance of generosity and kindness, as if the king is feeding them from his own table. This makes the Jews beneficiaries and dependents on the king. And this would have had a significant psychological impact on them after all of their suffering of their captivity. But this food appointed for the captives presents a problem for them. Verse 8 says, Daniel purposed in himself that he would not defile himself with the portions of the king's delicacies. The end of the verse, he requests to the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. This food was defiling. If he ate the king's food, he would have been made spiritually unclean. The way it's used, that word defile, the way it's used in the Old Testament, it means it's unfit to come before God. This food, if he ate it, would have been spiritually unfit to approach God. Now, we have no idea in what way it was unclean. It may have been offered to idols. It may have included portions from animals that the law of Moses declared was unclean. The Bible doesn't tell us why the food was unclean, just simply that it was. And Christians have spent a lot of time trying to figure out why the food would defile them. If that was important, the Bible would have told us. I know it would be nice to know, but it's really not the point at all. The Bible says it would defile the Jews who ate it. We don't have to know in what way it was unclean to be able to believe the Bible statement. This food was in some way prohibited by the law of Moses. Any Jew who ate it would be ritually and spiritually defiled by it. And this issue of this defiling food is the issue of this first chapter. Everything revolves around it. You have a little bit of an introduction that tells us how they end up in Babylon, how they get to the situation. You have a conclusion that tells us the outcome of the situation. But really, this issue, verses 8 to 16, are the heart of chapter 1. Daniel's response to this issue is astonishing. So if you can picture him as a 12-year-old boy who has suffered intensely, who has lost everything, probably a bit of his own sense of self. And now he's confronted with this question of eating the food provided by the king. Daniel responds with both conviction and wisdom. He resolved to not eat the king's food. That's what it says beginning in verse 8. He purposed in his heart he would not defile himself. And in fact, the way it's written suggests that he had apparently saw ahead of time that this would be an issue. And he determined before he was faced with the choice that he would obey God. He had previously established in his heart he would not eat that which God had forbidden. And when the food was offered to him, he followed through on his resolution. He kept a clear head despite long months of intensely painful circumstances. He had been torn away from his home and family. He had been shackled and forced to march hundreds of miles. He had was made a slave and a eunuch. The physical and emotional trauma had to be nearly overwhelming. In the midst of this fog of shock and terror and grief, Daniel continued to think clearly. He saw that eating the king's food would be a sin. He resolved he would not eat that which would defile him. And when the time came to keep that resolve, he did. In fact, Daniel was willing to risk his life to obey God. He requests of this chief of the eunuchs that he not eat the food, and he takes further steps, which we'll see in a minute. But his refusal of this food is a threat to his very life. Nebuchadnezzar has no love for Daniel. And causing a problem with the Babylonians, especially at that point in time, was more likely to cause them to remove Daniel than to do what he wanted. So in this case, the squeaky wheel was likely to get the axe. At best, he might be expelled from this training and forced to work in the mines or the quarries or the fields. If Daniel refused to eat the food appointed to him, the best likely outcome was a short life of hard labor. But despite that grave personal risk, Daniel refused to disobey God. And he obeyed God wisely. Daniel is not at all belligerent. He goes to the chief of the eunuchs and he makes a request. And then he seeks a reasonable way to obey God while still accomplishing the goals of his captors. Daniel is not at this point attempting to subvert the Babylonians. He's cooperating with them in achieving their goal. At least he's trying to. So he goes first to Ashpenaz and asks that he be given something to eat. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar had ordered this diet for these captives because he believed this food was most likely to make them healthy. And again, it appears generous, but it is not. Nebuchadnezzar was giving the best possible feed to his livestock so that they would be better able to work for him. That's what he's doing. He's caring for his property. He's not showing kindness. And if the servants of the king did not feed Daniel what had been appointed for him, their own well-being would be at risk. And Ashpenaz, as chief of the eunuchs, is responsible for the training of all of the captives, or these select captives. It tells us in verse 9 that God had brought Daniel into the favor and goodwill. That this Ashpenaz had great compassion on Daniel. And it appears that he is inclined to grant Daniel's request, but he can't. He's inclined to treat Daniel graciously, but his own life is at stake. So that if Ashpenaz acted on his own authority, and then his king's slaves were found to be in poor health, then Ashpenaz would be punished. He might even be put to death. So he tells Daniel in verse 10, "I fear my lord the king, who has appointed your food and drink. For why should he see your faces looking worse than the young men who are your age? then you would endanger my head before the king. What's interesting in this is Ashpenaz does not dismiss Daniel or simply refuse. He could have just said, no. No, go back to your school desk. He doesn't. He gave an explanation for why he could not agree to Daniel's request. It indicates the compassion he had towards Daniel, but it also, this explanation gave Daniel a way to pursue another approach. And so Daniel went down the corporate ladder to a lower level official. Verse 11, so Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had set over them. So there now he goes to the steward, the servant that Ashpenaz had placed directly over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And Daniel goes to this servant, this official, and he proposes a task. He suggests that this official give them water and vegetables. It might be grains. We're actually not entirely certain what this word refers to. It was definitely food far less desirable than the king's delicacies. But Daniel suggested that they eat these vegetables for 10 days and then compare their appearance with the others to see who was looking better. And this was a good solution for two reasons. First, the servant was farther down the ladder and not directly answerable to the king. Ashpenaz had to answer directly to Nebuchadnezzar. This servant answered at most to Ashpenaz. So his life was not as threatened as Ashpenaz's would have been. If it did not go well, Ashpenaz might rebuke the servant. He might punish him in some way. But the consequences would probably be far less severe. But second, this is a short trial. If the test does not go well, there's still lots of time to correct any deficiency in Daniel and his friends before they were to be presented to the king. And so this lower servant agrees to their test. Verse 14, he consented with them in this matter and tested them 10 days. And so for 10 days, these four Hebrew children practiced a vegan diet. They ate nothing but plant matter and they drank nothing but water. At the end of the 10 days, the servant examined them, and it says in verse 15, their features appeared better and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. So he found now that they were more healthy than their companions. So the servant says, all right, you look better than everybody else. He agrees to continue to give them vegetables to eat. And in the end, these boys were shown to be the top of their class. They were healthy, handsome, intelligent, and wise. And God gave them great knowledge and skill in the learning of the Babylonians. And this event is essential to our understanding of the character of the four Hebrew men. This is the first choice they make in this book. And they make a choice to obey God. We see them act with conviction, particularly Daniel, as he seems to be the leader in all of this. We see them act with skill and wisdom. And we see God bless them because they were committed to obeying him. And these four Hebrew boys are an incredible model of how to keep a clear head when faced with overwhelming circumstances or intense temptation. These boys are a model of wisdom that we can learn from. So in their obedience, I want to point out two elements of wisdom which ought to guide us in every difficult situation. The first element of wisdom, the most important, is they knew God was still in control. Remember, that is what this book is all about. God still rules. And they knew it. They were convinced of it. Now, if you look back at everything Daniel says in this chapter, He never says God is in control. He never mentioned God's rule at all. It's not their words that show they believe God was in control. It was their actions. Their faith must have been shaken by everything that happened to them. Remember, I said last week that all of the world would have seen the defeat of Jerusalem as proof the gods of the Babylonians were greater than the God of Israel. These four Hebrews had every reason to doubt or question that God was in control. But they continued to live in the conviction that God was supreme. They continued to live as if God was in complete control of their lives and circumstances. If they were did not believe God was in control, if they were questioning his power, then they would not have concerned themselves with eating unclean food. If God was not in complete control of all things everywhere, then they might have been persuaded that the laws of Moses were from a different time and for a different place. If they did not believe that God was still in complete control, they might have been ready to believe they could forget those old laws to keep up with their changing times. They did not believe that God had been defeated. They knew because God still rules, his commands still apply. And we often end up breaking God's commands in times of trouble because we begin to question God's rule. Now, sometimes people specifically deny God's goodness, wisdom, or rule. But many times, Christians do not outright deny those things. Instead, we begin to question those things. There begins to be the hint of a suspicion that maybe God wasn't in complete control of that situation. And so we question God. Why, God? Why did this happen to me? And often the implication there is, God, are you sure you know what you're doing? Sometimes we protest that the circumstance is not fair. We conclude we don't deserve what happened. And again, the question of deserving and fairness is actually not the question. Because what's at stake there, what's going on, is we're suggesting that God messed up. That God did not perfectly rule in that situation so that something happened to me that in all actuality should not have happened. Now, we may never quite come out and say God is not in control or God messed up. But often the result is the same. We begin to minimize God's rule, lessen God's goodness, or question his wisdom. And when we do that, we will begin to act as if God is not really in complete control. He's not in control of this situation. Therefore, I can respond how I want rather than how he says to respond. And again, probably few of us, if any of us, actually articulate that logic in our own minds. But the end result is that we begin to act as if God's laws don't apply, mine do, because God messed up here. God's hand slipped a little bit. So now I need to take care of things. And we need to be completely convinced that God rules over all circumstances and in all places. So that God still rules when you're trying to merge on the interstate. God still rules when your neighbor is setting off fireworks at 1 a.m. or when your cat wakes you up at 1 a.m. because of the neighbor's fireworks. Personal testimony there. So, God still rules when the doctor tells you you have cancer. God still rules when your grandchild contracts a fatal disease. God still rules when your life falls apart. And God's loving rule ought to be our comfort in those devastating situations. But God's loving control also ought to be a reason to continue to obey God. Since God rules in all circumstances, in all places, then God's laws still apply in all circumstances, in all places. He does not provide exception clauses in the New Testament which permit us to disobey Him if this happens. God rules all of life, and He expects us to obey. So the first element of wisdom is they never forgot. They never doubted that God was in complete control. The second element of wisdom that we see in these chapters, these four Hebrew boys understood what was really at stake. And personally, I think this is one of the most incredible things about this whole account, is they understood what was really going on despite incredible pressure. They remained clear-headed. Despite being overwhelmed with information, they understood what was most important. They were having to figure out how to cope with the loss of their home and families, and there were no grief counselors offered to them. They were being forced to learn a new language, a new culture, a new way of looking at the world. They were being forced to make decisions about obedience to God while racked by physical and emotional pain, and while attempting to make sense of a flood of new information and new experiences. And on top of all of that information overload was the ever-present deception of temptation. Do not think for a moment that these four boys are only facing something from the outside. But within their own heart was temptation bubbling up. And the pressure to disobey was made harder to resist because of that temptation. And part of what temptation does is it constantly attempts to distort reality by making the most important seem less important. Temptation lies and says this, whatever trivial thing, matters more than obedience. Temptation, I'm sure, was offering them excuses, justifications, and rationalizations. Temptation may have told them it didn't matter if they ate unclean food. Jerusalem was a long way away. They were never going to return. They were never going to worship at the temple. The laws of unclean food were just so they could go offer sacrifices. Since they're never going to be able to do that again, what does it matter if they have a little bit of pork? It's just a piece of bacon. You're never going back to Jerusalem. Temptation whispered that they could just say they were forced to eat the unclean food. They didn't want to, but they really didn't have a choice. So as long as they had to eat that which defiled them, it'd be okay, right? Temptation is offering, you can probably think of other excuses, rationalizations of why it was okay. So these men, they're being overwhelmed by information from outside, pressured by temptation from within, but they never lost sight of truth. They kept a clear head. They knew if they ate the king's meat, it would defile them. And they knew defilement affected their relationship with God. They knew relationship with God is not just a matter of religious rituals at temple, but personal devotion and fellowship with God. They knew the issue of eating the king's meat was not ultimately a question of food or how to survive in a difficult place. They knew the issue of eating the king's meat was a question of obedience to God and relationship with Him. They knew that defiling themselves with the king's meat would damage their walk with God. So despite the confusion of their lives, they were crystal clear about what was really at stake. If we're going to live like God is in control of all circumstances, then we must keep that clear head in all temptations. Sin muddles matters, and it muddles our minds. and to keep a clear head. We really have to develop the wisdom to see what is really at stake. So for example, this requires learning that when you resort to sinful means to resolve a problem, then you are disobeying God and hindering your relationship with Him. It may solve the problem, but you have sacrificed the most important for something of less importance. This requires learning that when you are in a painful situation and you begin to question God's wisdom, you begin to doubt His wisdom, what you're actually doing is defaming and slandering the one who rules all. You are, in fact, implying that you are wiser than God. You're saying, I wouldn't have done it this way. God must have messed up. You are suggesting that God is less than one of His creatures. And wisdom learns to think clearly about what is really at stake in your circumstances, in your temptations. And Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are a model of wise obedience. They show us in chapter 1, and they will continue to show us how to live wisely in a world which hates God. They show us how to live wisely in the world, recognizing that God still rules all things. They show us that true wisdom sees through the fog of circumstances and temptation. True wisdom is not misled by the pressures. So they show us that we must learn the wisdom to obey God. Always obey God. No matter what the circumstances are. No matter what the temptations are. No matter what pressure is put upon us. But to recognize that God is in control. And I must obey God.